Amen. All right, we've been talking about the importance of story, in particular, the story that leads into the Gospels, that flows into the first century. So last class period, we started talking about the pre-exilic period. And what you guys were doing were just kind of helping me storytell some of your favorite stories from Genesis to Judges. And anybody think of any other ones outside of the ones we mentioned yesterday that you were like, oh yeah, I needed to say this one, and I forgot.
I like the story of Joseph being sold into slavery and then becoming powerful.
Yeah.
Just because I think it's really ironic and sort of like, not that God gives people the middle finger, but if he did, I think that's how he'd do it.
Okay. Good, interesting interpretation. There we go. Okay. Yeah, Joseph, though. Fantastic story. Really interesting story. What else?
Job.
Intriguing story. Hardest Hebrew in the entire Old Testament, by the way. Hello. Matter of fact, some of the entire phrases could go the opposite direction in Job, just depending on what vowel pointings we want to give it or take away. Pretty fascinating in Job. But even his struggle, I don't like the concept of the patience of Job, because that's not exactly what Job was. He wasn't really patient. He was perseverant. Perseverance of Job is one thing, but patience, I don't think that makes much sense unless we redefine the word patience. Job's an interesting character, and so are his ridiculous friends that come along and talk. One of the things, honestly, that teaches me most about Job, or Job teaches me more about anything, is the most important question whenever you're in times of tribulation. I think I've mentioned it in this class, maybe it was in Revelation, I don't know, they're all blend together. But I was asked by a student at a question answer time at a Revelation seminar, a young guy, young kid, maybe like 11, was asking me basically the problem of evil. And he was just like, you know, what do you do with the problem of evil? Why doesn't God just, you know? And I looked at him and I just said, man, you know, after the tornado, I've heard that question a lot, in a lot of different ways. Why did God let this happen? Why did God save this person miraculously, but these 160 he didn't? Why didn't that tornado just rip through a bunch, you know, at a different even time? Or why did, you know, a lot of different ways of asking the same question. What do we do with an all-powerful God that can't protect his people? Or what we think he should be doing? Why is there evil? And I just looked at the kid and I just said, here's what I learned from Job. The question of why can never be answered. It's actually not the most important question. Yet it's the question we're obsessed with. But that's not the right question. The question is, do you trust the who? It's always a question of identity. Times of trial and suffering, a lot of times whenever it starts to become something that affects your faith, it's because there was something wrong with the who in your mind to begin with. If you understand the who, the why takes care of itself. You can never satisfactorily answer the why. You can never answer it. I could give you 1,000 reasons of why this happened in tornado, and frankly, most of them probably contradicting each other. And every one of them somebody would not be satisfied with or be offended by. You can never get a good why answer. It's one of the things, like my wife and I, when we experienced our miscarriage, man, the answers to the why question that we weren't asking, but everybody thought we should be asking, ticked me off. I remember telling, I was working in my basement, putting up some drywall with the guy that was kind of like my second father growing up. And I asked him, I just told him, I said, we had a miscarriage. And I wasn't asking any questions. I was just informing him. And he says, well, you know why that happened, right? And I said, no, I don't know why that happened. He goes, well, it's because God has something better in store for you. And I didn't. But I wanted to look at him and say, please, sir, tell me what is better than my child living. Just please rank it for me so I can understand this. We think we need to answer the why question. That's just dumb. Job wanted why. Why are you doing this to me? Why have you taken my wife? Why have you taken my children? Why have you taken all my wealth? Why? And God says, that's the wrong question. It's the who. You know where the why question belongs, but we don't want to ask it? where we don't want to ask it, but it belongs securely. Why did God give you anything that you do have? That's where the why question belongs. But as people in the richest country in the history of the world, we don't want to ask that question because then we may have to do something with it. Where we want the why question to be, where we've even positioned the same questions, usually is an assault on God himself. So we'll ask the why question we can blame him for, but we won't ask the why question when it requires something for us. Ultimately, even where we place the why question is affected by who we think he is. Do I believe that God is all-powerful? Yes. Do I believe that God is all-knowing? Absolutely. Do I believe that God is love? Yes. Therefore, the why question I'll never answer, but if I trust who he is, I will find comfort. When you're in the hospital rooms of your ministries, whenever you're dealing with grieving yourself, if you're trying to give the answers of why or trying to wrestle with the question of why, you will be sorely disappointed. And eventually, God has to get rowdy with Job and says, start asking who. Where were you whenever I laid the foundations of the earth? Where were you whenever I called Leviathan from the rocks of the earth? Where were you? Do you even know where the storehouses laden with snow are? Have you ever seen those? Oh, okay. So your why question is pretty stupid when you understand who I am in comparison to who you are. Don't ask why, just trust who I am. I can't do that. That's the problem. It's not the why, that's the problem. The problem with evil is not a problem with we can't logically understand it. The problem of evil is our problem with refusing to accept who God is in spite of what we think we can deduce about him. Tom Tatterfield, I think, and my little brother gave a responding quote, but he gave this really good quote on Facebook by Origen. And Origen basically says, are you still obsessed with the logical reason of the world, or have you realized how futile it really is? The more you understand the depths of reason, the more you realize that reason can't deliver anything that faith can. So to be able, I think attaching that to another Katina quoting here, another quote, Rick Ashley once was quoted as saying, we all want a God that's so big he can do anything, but so small we can understand everything he does. That's just dumb. Do you trust who? Then the why question needs to just take care of itself. And that's Job. In a nutshell, that's Job. Good story. A pretty important story during the exile period, what we get to in a bit. Other stories that you guys thought of pre-exile, up to around the judges? None? We already covered them all? Yeah, if that's okay.
Not
for
really
you.
A story, but last night I was doing some memory work for another class. Mm-hmm. It's Hebrews 1:1 actually, where it says, in the past God spoke. And that actually hit me.
Yeah.
How that's kind of a theme through the whole thing. And God said, then the Lord said too. And just this idea of God being willing just to even communicate is honestly phenomenal.
It is pretty phenomenal with all these different stories. It communicates a couple of really powerful things. One of them is just the sheer power of God. He speaks and stuff happens. Because that reminds me, when you thought of Hebrews 1:1, whenever you said that, I was like, yeah, he speaks the word, John 1:1. And then the second thing is that he speaks, and that's powerful because it is this powerful being initiating something with us. Why? I mean, how many of you have had a relationship initiated by Obama? That's not a criticism of him. It's just that normally powerful people don't stoop to hang out with the low ones. It's one of the reasons why on the political trail, they want their picture taken with holding every, Plumber Joe's baby. You know what I mean? Whatever they can do to make it feel like they're rubbing elbows with the lower people, that's what they'll do. Why? Because that is absurd. Absurd. That someone in that type of a power would stoop down to hang out with somebody on Main Street. That's ridiculous. And yet God spoke to us. It's one of the reasons why I get a little bit annoyed, and this is probably appropriate for me to talk about this because this is a major point in the period we're talking about. a little bit annoyed with the way we treat the law now that we have found grace. They're not enemies. In the right context, they're actually almost one and the same. Whenever the Israelites saw the law, they didn't say, "Oh my gosh, the yoke has now been put on us." They said, "Finally, a God's communicated to us what they want. Now we know how to navigate through life. This is a joyous moment." Whenever now we gain an identity because He's given us His identity and told us what He desires. Now no longer we have to shoot in the dark and wonder if we've ticked off this God or this God or this God or this God. Now we know what He wants. And when the consequences come for what we do, we saw Him coming. He told us. That's called grace. That's an amazing movement of love, receiving the law. But we spit every time we hear the word law. Jesus even flat out says, "I didn't come to abolish it. I came to fulfill it." I mean, that's in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5. But man, we act like that Paul just ripped it. No, read Paul closely. What is Paul fighting? He's fighting the position of the law in a lot of our lives. The position of the law being used to divide the people of God. The position of the law is the problem. It's not the law itself. The law itself is very good. It is very grace-filled. And it leads us to ridiculous things like, well, what we do means absolutely nothing about our relationship and salvation with God because we're under grace. That's stupid. That's not biblical. That's not biblical at all. You're darn right God expects you to do stuff. It's because we're in a covenant, friends. And all covenants have obligations on both sides. So this whole idea, well, I don't want to work for my salvation. Okay, nobody said you were, but you better be working. Because that's how you participate in the salvation that Jesus is offering. I mean, it's a very simple concept. Why does Revelation say 5 out of the 7 churches, "I know your deeds"? Or Revelation chapter 2, whenever he's talking to Sardis, or excuse me, 3, when he's talking to Sardis, and he says, "I have not found your deeds complete in the eyes of my God." Or Revelation 14, 13, whenever he says, "Blessed are those who die from now on, for I am coming, and I will repay each one according to what he has done." And Revelation 22, 16, whenever Jesus says, "Behold, I am coming soon, and I am bringing my reward with me to give to everyone according as they have done." Sorry, deeds matter, friends. Sorry, they do. And you'd understand that if you didn't just, you know, spit on the law. We act like it's just a stupid concept, like God made a mistake by giving the law and he undid it at the cross. No, he didn't. The cross was always the plan. So was the law. Matter of fact, if I was going to be describing key elements in this pre-exilic period, there'd be 5 I would go to. You have to talk about these 5 if you're talking about the pre-exilic period. Now, I know in isolating these 5, I'm leaving out some big ones. Like, for example, I am not going to talk about creation. And it's not that I don't think it's important. It's just I'm going to skip over that one because there are 5 major things that really are you have to keep on the radar. God created everything in chapters 1 and 2 of Genesis, but where does it lead to? What is the climax of this initial story? The fall. Humanity undoing what God created. The fall, Genesis 3. You cannot understand the entire Old Testament or the New Testament without having the fall clearly in place. It is the point whenever humanity decides that the image of God that He has given them at that moment is not good enough. That they want an image of God that even supersedes that which God has given them. That's the thing that's so ironic. The temptation is if you eat of this fruit, you will become even like God Himself. Which if you'd have just flipped over 2 chapters earlier, God already said, "I made you like myself. I made you in my image." Holy crap. That was totally a bird that just slammed in there. Sorry, that really frightened me. I'm glad that crap's the only word I said. Wow, that could have been really awkward. Huh, what was I talking about? Maybe that wasn't heresy, was it? That's what I'm saying, man. I felt like a falcon was coming through the window. Holy cow. Man, what was I talking about? Either the devil doesn't want me to say it or God's trying to correct me. Let's see, what were we talking about? The fall! Whoa! Okay. That's never happened to me before.
This room is awesome. Isn't
it? What is it? Yeah, this room is amazing. Even the birds went in. I don't know. What are we talking about? Us denying the image of God that's within us. Whoa. I'll get back on track here eventually. It'd have been really funny if we were talking about Noah when he sent out the birds, and then that went anyway. But we weren't, so I won't push it a couple chapters later. Okay. The fall. We're literally the image of God that he has given us, we've chosen to reject. As a matter of fact, Irenaeus believes that the further that you commit yourself to sin, the more you actually lose the image of God that you were initially given. And he says that's why demons and people that are evil, they can only be characterized by thick darkness, because they've literally seared all the light from out from them. They have no image of God in them. Where people that go further and further away from God tend to act more and more like animals, indiscriminately giving into their instincts, whether lustful instincts or violent instincts. And Irenaeus says it's because they're becoming like that which does not have the image of God. Pretty fascinating, but it makes a lot of sense with the fall. The fall, though, leads to, I think, another major pillar is the covenant with Abraham. You cannot understand the new covenant, the New Testament, without the covenant of Abraham. Covenant of Abraham, whenever God initiates a relationship with his people, he initiates it. It is God saying, I will be bound to you, and you will be bound to me. And therefore, I will make your descendants as many as the stars in the heavens. Very powerful moment, which I think leads to the next major pillar, the Exodus. Because how do you understand the nation of Israel if you don't understand the covenant of Abraham that ultimately, in a sense, is enacted in the Exodus? The Exodus is this, I almost said watershed moment. It was, but that pun was not intended, where God proves to his people his obligation to this covenant of liberation. The Exodus becomes the key motif that the Israelites, whether they're in exile, whether in the time of Jesus, matter of fact, a lot of your New Testament Gospels will be depicting the actions of Jesus in the actions of Moses to show that he is offering a new Exodus. It's what they were longing for with the Maccabean Revolt. Whenever the people would go into the desert, I was reading this in Adela Yarbrough Collins' book, The Combat Myth of Revelation, the other day, where she says, especially after post-Maccabean Revolt, the image of the desert is always associated to a new Exodus. And so whenever the woman in chapter 12 of Revelation goes into the desert, it is what you're expecting is not just an Exodus, but you're expecting the conquering of the Promised Land. Because that's what that all is tied up in this Exodus. Which is why I find it very fascinating that you see kind of the Exodus being paralleled in Matthew chapter 3 when Jesus is baptized. And then he goes out into the wilderness in chapter 4, just like what you see, what happened to the Israelites in the Exodus wilderness. And then you have chapters 5 through 7, the Sermon on the Mount, which leads right up to it, where he receives the law the same way, which I think is the fourth pillar, Sinai, the law. But then what you would expect after the law, after the wandering in the wilderness, you'd expect the conquest of the Promised Land. And in chapters 8 and 9, what you find is 12 miracle scenes, where he's going throughout the land, conquering it, not the way that it was conquered in the days of old, but conquering it through his healings of those that are broken. That's why the second miracle event in Matthew chapter 8 is fascinating, because it is a Roman centurion, the one he is supposed to be killing and conquering. And he says, I've not found faith like this in all of Israel. Oh, Jesus, you're going to get yourself hung on a cross. Question? Somebody had their hand up. I don't remember who it was. But
I was just going to ask you, do you think that's what he was doing
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, right.
He talks about, like, the sword and stuff like that kind of language there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. But the sword's even different. Yeah. And the irony of that scene as well is that they think they're going to be going out as the ones sent by God to take over the Promised Land through force. And then he says, actually, when you go out, the force is going to be used against you. Which is one of the reasons why in chapter 11 you have John the Baptist going, I don't think you're the Messiah. Why? Because you're not conquering the Promised Land like you should be. And Jesus says, oh, silly John. From women's womb, man, verse 11, no one has ever come out as better than you, except the least in the kingdom of heaven will be greater than you. Why? Because verse 12 says, up until now, until from the days of John the Baptist until now, the kingdom has been advancing violently through the through violent men that have laid hold of it. But everything's different now. So John didn't get it because he was looking for what he saw in the Old Testament. And that makes sense. John's probably also sitting there going, if you're the Messiah, why am I in prison? It's a bit odd. I thought I was, you know, the Elijah that came, you know, no. So, okay. Anyway. The third, yes, sorry, go ahead.
So do you agree with the whole, like, new Exodus idea, like, outside of Matthew? Like, Jesus didn't just say you individualistically, you need to think of the whole, like, there is an Exodus. Most of Matthew is written to show that Jesus is greater than Moses.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The greater than Moses one, I agree with that, but I think that even the concept of reducing him down to Moses is a bit problematic. He is enacting Moses to implicate what Moses was doing. Moses is the key figure in the Old Testament in establishing the nation of Israel. And I think the reason why Jesus is mirroring a lot of the Israelite story as well as a lot of Moses is not even to show his status as much as what he is accomplishing. And that is he is establishing a nation, which is the church.
What about like the idea of Jesus as Israel?
Yes and no. It's the difficulty with metaphors. Mm-hmm. Metaphors have multiple layers. There are times when Jesus is acting as Israel. Whenever he says, out of Egypt I called my son. He's clearly typologically then functioning as Israel. And typologically, for example, in the feeding of the 5,000, he is functioning as Moses. But to miss what the, in other words, this is what I'm wrestling with right now with my PhD that I get a little frustrated by. I love our connections because they're good, but we usually stop whenever we make the connection and be like, wow, that was great. And I'm saying, but why did Matthew choose that connection?
Well, isn't Matthew like more targeted towards Jews anyways?
Theoretically, yes. So yes.
Like, wouldn't that make sense? Mm-hmm. If he's like, Moses is gone. We're
on to
this new guy. He's pretty awesome.
Well, and it's not... And they would definitely have gotten a hold of it. And it's not even so much of Jesus supplanting Moses. It is Jesus is in this... We're not... The church in Israel's relationship is so strange. Because people accuse me especially of replacement theology. Jesus replaced Moses, or the church replaced Israel. That's not what I'm saying. The church is Israel because we are a continuation of what Moses tried to establish but was lost. So more than it's this new guy, it's Moses going, this is what we've always been driving towards. There is no the Old Testament break, now the New Testament church. It's, this is the story of God's people. They were once this ethnic tribe. But God's people morphed, transformed, was redeemed into not ethnicity, but something that's characterized by something even greater than ethnicity. So it's not, that's why I think Jesus even says, I didn't come to abolish the law. It's not like I'm stopping and starting something new. It's I'm fulfilling it. Now it does change because in the word fulfill itself, you have to have change. Otherwise, it can't be fulfilled. You know what I mean by that? If I look at something and I say, I fulfilled the task, then I have to say that 5 minutes before, when it was not fulfilled, something has changed in that 5 minutes to where now, even though it's the same task, now it has changed. See what I mean? Jesus is saying, it's the same people, people of Israel. It's the Old Testament story. We're not stopping and starting something. That's why I don't even totally like the word New Testament. We're not totally starting something new in the sense of ex nihilo out of nothing. We are the fulfillment of all that the Old Testament is moving towards. We are Israel. It's just that Israel is now fulfilled. Therefore, it will have changed. And the very definition of Israel has changed, and that's what Paul spends most of his ministry doing. We read this in Revelation, Romans 9, verse 6. Paul says, not all who are Israel. Why? Because the definition of the very word has changed. How do you define the word Israel? God's people. And Jesus changed the definition of God's people. Is this making sense? This is why the story is so important. So absolutely, Matthew is talking to the Jewish people. But what's so significant about what you said was, they know the story. And so for them, they're going, wow, this, all of a sudden, the concept of Jesus, it's not just that. And even Hebrews, I think we do a disservice of saying that Hebrews' whole point is just to say he's superior than. Well, I mean, they're not having to argue for superiority with Jesus all the time. Now, don't get me wrong, that issue does come up. It's bigger than that. It's in the context of the whole story. Jesus just doesn't want to be bigger than Moses. He wants to complete what Moses began. But the only person that could complete it is someone that, that has to be shrouded in the mystery of the incarnation, because how else can... You see how this is making sense? I just get a little nervous. Anyway, yes. Okay. So we have the fall, the covenant with Abraham, the Exodus, Sinai. And I've already kind of talked about that some. But what you need to understand is that the giving of the law, all laws are so important, because laws are what define the identity of a people. Laws are not just rules to be kept. Laws are what define the identity of the people, which is why, if I'm going to bring this to an Ozarkian application, it does bother me whenever people really want to just reject or act like that the rules of Ozark don't matter. Because you don't understand that whenever you're rebelling against a law, you're rejecting the identity of the people that hold to those laws. It's a bigger issue than just breaking a rule. It always has been. Even in the Old Testament, it always is. It's you're saying, I don't want to be a part of that community. More than you are saying, oh, I broke a little rule. No, it's not about breaking a rule. It's about your identity as a part of that community. And if the community has laid out these rules, then if you want to be a part of the community, then those are the rules you abide by. And if you don't like the rules, either change them from within through a healthy way, or get out of the community. Very simple. Same thing with America. It's the same whole concept in our incarceration system. If you don't abide by the rules of the community, we will take you out of the community. You will be isolated by yourself. Does that make sense? And even within there, they have new community rules. Rules are not something just to have, and I'm not saying it isn't always used this way, but it's not just something that is wielding power over others. Rules also, especially the laws at Sinai, are identifying a people, which is one of the reasons why he spends the first four commandments talking about this relationship, and then the last six talking about this one. Because this and this together is what defines us as a people. It gives us an identity. And so therefore, whenever you're breaking the laws of Sinai, it's not so much that you've missed a rule and God gets upset and wants to wrap you on the knuckles with his ruler. It's that you're rejecting the identity of the community. And if you're rejecting the identity of the community, you're rejecting his identity as well. It's a bigger issue than breaking a rule. Is this making sense? It's a bigger issue than just breaking a rule. It's one of the reasons why whenever I'm disciplining my kids, there's sometimes I look at him and I say, Zion, we do not do that in our family. If you're a part of our family, you do not do that. You don't treat people that way. It's not the way you act. Because in our family, this is how we treat people. What I'm saying is, since you're a part of our family, there will be things that you will do, and there'll be things you don't do. If you continue to do that, well, I'm not going to kick him out of my family. But you hear the idea. I do love the honor-shame cultures and the way they discipline their children, though. Mark Moore tells about this all the time, where his brother... married someone from, I believe she was Asian. I don't know that exactly, but from an honor-shame culture. And the way she would discipline their son is she would put him on the front doorstep and lock the door. And he would sit there for hours crying and beating on the door, wanting back in. Because what she has said is, since you are not obeying the rules of this community, you've been set outside of the community. And until you start obeying the rules, you're not allowed back in. Which is one of the reasons why Matthew 18 is such an important passage. When a brother sins against you, two of you go. And if he obeys you, you've won him over, job well done. If he doesn't, you take a couple more people with you. If he still sins against you and disobeys, you take him for the whole church. And if he still disobeys, you set him outside of the community. Excommunication is not a consequence. Excommunication is like disciplining a child, hoping that the child will say, I want to be a part of the community. Excommunication, the idea of it is restoration, not kicking out. It's not judgment. The idea is redemption. You excommunicate someone so that they understand the identity of the community and come back and be a part of it, not so that you can get rid of a problem. Is that making sense? God doesn't kick us outside of the community or give us rules that say you'll be set outside the community so that he doesn't have to deal with us. It's so that we will conform to his image, which is embedded in the community. Is this making sense? If you don't understand Sinai, you don't understand Israel. Gotta understand Sinai. Not from the false Pauline perspective, but from the Old Testament perspective. This is a beautiful moment. And then obviously, the fifth and final of this time period, the fifth and final major pillar that I would suggest is the Promised Land. You've got to understand what the Promised Land meant to them and their identity. All of these events is developing who they are, which is much more important than what they do. This is my whole Christian life is based off of this one quote. It's from Stuart Briscoe, although he claims he never said it, but he told me to credit him anyway because I didn't make it up. So Stuart Briscoe once said, "The more you tell someone who they are, the less you'll have to tell them what to do." That's so true. I just was given this lecture yesterday in Christian life. One of the reasons why our churches are so jacked up, it's not because they don't know what to do. How do you pray exactly? It's because they don't know who they are. They have no idea who they are. And we're not telling them. We just keep slapping labels on them as if that accomplishes something. You're a Christian. Oh, good. What does that mean? You know, I mean, it looks like I got baptized like at the age of 9, July 12th, 1991. And I remember getting out of the baptismal and I remember asking, "Now what?" "Now you're saved," is what I was told. Okay. And nothing about me changed. That's ridiculous. They forgot to tell me who I was. I long for the day whenever the church changes these labels we've put on them into identities, where we look at the body of Christ as not something that we say, "See, that's my name tag," but we look at the body of Christ as something that compels us to do what the original body of Christ did himself. Whenever God says you are, or whenever Paul says you are the temple. So we don't learn that as a label, but we understand that literally we are where heaven and earth intersect. And we need to take God to the people, to be the intercessors for people that are in need. The Promised Land. Promised Land's about identity. God proves his ability to deliver on his part of the covenant. He says, "I will take care of you." And this is, in a visible seal of his covenant with his people. Five major pillars. But there is a sixth one that I think may be we need to read it. 1 Samuel chapter 8, major moment in the history of Israel. Major moment. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1, we're going to read, I think, through 22 or something. When Samuel grew old, who's Samuel? Give me the generic answer for that. Not Jesus. Who's Samuel? What? He's a prophet. He is the mouthpiece of God that guides the people of Israel to make sure that they stay true to their identity. That's the prophet's job. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judge for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. Sorry, I'm laughing because I just sat there and thought, man, if Samuel's sons turn out the way they did, then never mind. And they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. How can a prophet of God not be a good father? I've actually seen that more than once in my lifetime around people that I think are very holy. They're terrible fathers. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. Notice that last one, by the way. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old and your sons do not walk in your ways." That right there, so far, that is what elders are supposed to do. That is good. They're saying, there's a problem that's brewing. For you're old and about to die and your sons are a mess. We've got to come up with a solution. What is God, instead of asking this question, what is God going to do to fill this hole? This is what they demand. So, now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord, and the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king." Did you hear that? You want to know one of the reasons why Jesus didn't come back in the Gospels and establish an earthly kingdom for Israel to reign out of Zion? It's because that entire kingdom is based on rebellion from God as their true king. It actually kind of disturbs me that eschatologically some people are still looking for an earthly kingdom. Do you know what the earthly kingdom is connected to in the Old Testament? Rejection of God. Rebellion against their king. We want to be like the other nations. We want to rule like them and have palaces like them and have armies like them. And we want to have kings like, we want to be like them. What is that a shift of? Not policy, identity. As they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they're now doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and his horses, and they will run in front of his chariots." Battle. "Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best in your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No. Samuel says, "You're asking for bondage." Because the agenda of God is different than the agenda of this world. And if you're asking to be like the other nations, the one that's ruling you will be basing his judgments off of the agenda of the world. He will look like the world, function like the world, fight like the world, hoard like the world. He will use you as his slaves to build his empire. That's what you're asking. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like the other nations, with the king to lead us and go out and to go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." The rest of the Old Testament is outplaying the consequences of this moment. Because what you see throughout the rest of the Old Testament is the deterioration between humanity and God. The relationship that he established, what you see is just deterioration. They want a king, we'll give him a king. But it's not going to work out good. I've already told them. It's not. And what does this lead to? Let me say this. This is pretty important too. There is a reason why, especially in the pre-exilic period, one of the most repeated words is the word remember. Remember. Remember the Lord. Remember what the Lord did in Exodus. Remember what the Lord did for you in Egypt. Remember what the Lord did for you in the wilderness. Remember, remember, remember. Why? Why is remembering so important? Reminds them of who their God is.
Reminds them of what they gave up.
Reminds them of what they gave up. Yeah. Reminds
them of who they are.
It reminds them of who they are. Yeah. Remembering is so important. It's one of the reasons why I think Jesus brings that word up in the Lord's Supper. It's not a cognitive thing to remember. Don't let the Enlightenment reduce the word down, remember, down to basically nothing. It's not a cognitive thing. Remembering the Lord, remembering what he has done, remembering what Jesus has done, is supposed to define who you are. Because you are defined by who God is. And the way you know who God is by knowing what he has done. Remember the Lord. Why? So that you will know who you are and you'll know how to act. Remember what the Lord did for you. Why? So then you will know who you are and you'll know how to act. That's why Deuteronomy chapter 6, very important passage as well in the history of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verse 4, you've heard this part several times. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. What is that doing right there? Right before the greatest commandment, what does that verse do? It identifies God. It gives them his identity. Why? So then they can know who they are. Remember, O Israel, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk along the road, when you lie down and when you get up. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frame of your houses and on your gates. When the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to your fathers. Notice what he's doing. He's reminding them of the story. When he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to you a land with large flourishing cities that you did not build. Houses filled with all kinds of good things that you did not provide. Wells you did not dig. And vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. Then when you eat and are satisfied, be careful that you do not forget the Lord, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. What's he doing? Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name. Do not follow other gods, the gods of the people and those around you. For the Lord your God who is among you is a jealous God, and his anger will burn against you, and he will destroy you from the face of the land. Do not test the Lord your God as you did at Massah. Be sure to keep the commands of the Lord your God and the stipulations and decrees he has given you. Do what is right and good in the Lord's sight, so that it may go well with you, and you may go in and take over the good land that the Lord promised on oath to your forefathers, thrusting out all your enemies before you, as the Lord said. What do you hear over and over and over and over? What do you hear over and over? The cadence of what I was even reading, what was sticking out? The Lord. The Lord your God. The Lord. The Lord your God. Yahweh, those are all capital letters if you look in your Bible. Covenantal name. The Lord your God. Relational terms. If you know who he is, you will know who you are and you'll know what to do. So whenever Israel starts to rebel, they are not just breaking rules. They don't get kicked into exile just because they broke some rules. They get moved into exile because they reject their identity by rejecting God's identity. It's one of the things that fascinates me, where they're so upset that they're moved into exile and that God, in a sense, is mocked and taunted by the Babylonians. It baffles me that they're so upset because of the way they've treated his identity. They clearly didn't want to be a part of his identity, because that's why they kept whoring themselves out to other gods. And it makes God so mad that in Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 8, he said, after Israel, talking about the northern kingdom, had committed adultery so many times, I gave her her certificate of divorce. Why? Because she begged me for it. And it didn't even shake Judah, for Judah kept on committing adulteries herself. God says, what was happening? Why did the exile happen? Because they rejected me. They rejected me. They denied my identity. They wanted to embrace their own. You see what's happening here? Reflect on this. How does this in any way inform the story of the Gospels? Or how does this even change the way that we interact with the exile, or that we interact with the pre-exilic period? What is the purpose, or what are you reflecting as far as the purpose of the Old Testament in your own mind at this point? Notice I gave you like five different questions, so you can pick one and just reflect on that one.
I just think it's interesting that when Jesus comes to reestablish the kingdom, that he tells them his identity, and he gives them the choice to accept that identity, to re-become the people, rather than like making them have an identity so that they can reject it again. He just
yeah. Yeah. It's one of the reasons why whenever, you know, we're pejoratively called Christians, little Christ, it's like, man, that's the perfect name. My Christian life class is so remedial and simple. And yet it really ticks some people off. But it's just basic. My whole Christian life class is this. If we are the body of Christ, we should act like the Christ did when he was in a body. What he did, we do. But if you start talking about wanting to do the things Jesus did and not wanting to do the things Jesus didn't do, people will want to crucify you. Even some people sitting in your pews. Be careful how much you hang out with the poor. Be careful how much you talk about loving the least of these. Be careful how much talking about loving your enemies. Talk about those issues enough, people want to kill you. But I just want to do what Jesus did, and I don't want to do what he didn't do, because that's who I am, and that's because of who he was. I do not understand myself outside of who Jesus is. I don't get it. Other thoughts, reflections?
It's interesting, because I mean, I've read justification and stuff, but just your little timelines up there, because you always just do think of the law contradicting or being against grace, or grace somehow overcoming the law instead of fitting in with the law, or an appropriate, or the one and the same, just different manifestations in certain ways, or I don't even know how to have vocabulary to express that, but it's good.
Yeah, you know, I'm wrestling with this concept right now, and I don't know what to do with it, and I'll tell you in incipient form so that you can wrestle with it yourself, maybe come with a better conclusion than where I'm at. I just don't know what to do with it yet. But there's an article, and I can't remember the guy that wrote it yet, but it's in the book called God as Stricken, or Stricken by God. And it's a book it's a compilation of a bunch of different chapters. And the guy writes this chapter on the substitutionary atonement. And he is saying, yes, Jesus was a substitutionary atonement. But he says, here's what the interesting thing is we've always been wrestling with who is the ransom paid to. This need for the blood, this need for who is the ransom paid to. And his theory is that what was appeased in Jesus was not the lust for violence from God or the lust of violence for Satan, but he is appeasing the lust of violence for humanity. And he goes back and shows how that's what the high priest actually was doing. That the killing of the animals was not something that was appeasing what God desired. It was something that was appeasing what humanity had created themselves to be. Fascinating study. Don't know what to do with it exactly. But ultimately, it puts the continuation of the Old Testament covenant and what Jesus did in a little bit of a different light. The problem always has been us. It's always been us. I don't know.
Are there any, OT parallels to it?
Absolutely. He basically goes through the way in which, I believe it's in Sirach, he uses apocryphal and pseudepigraphical works to reconstruct the actual movements of the high priest during the atonement sacrifices, and shows that in those it seems to indicate that where the appeasement's coming is the violence of the people that had committed the sins. That's what's trying to be appeased. It's
BAR, a month ago, maybe 2 months ago, they wrote a big article, it's like one of their main articles, about how what separated Israel with their animal sacrifices. If we look at Egypt, Mesopotamia, their gods ate the sacrifice. But Israel couldn't have an image of God, so we don't know what they were sacrificing.
That's interesting. Yeah. And it kind of plays in this guy's theory, and I don't know what to do with it yet, but I think it's fascinating. I think it needs to be explored. Let's just sum this up with this. The importance of knowing the story is the importance of identity. Not just of who you are, but of who God is. And ultimately, it has to be in the reverse order. You want to know who you are, then you need to know more who God is, because that's who he's created you to be. And ultimately, then you'll know what to do. And we'll talk about, though, the way in which they get off track going into the exile tomorrow. And we will start getting into some heavy history where I'll give you timelines that you need to start writing down. Oh, joyful fun. Love you guys. See you in the morning. Okay.